Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest and hopefully the greatest adventure here on Planet Porky, Life on Planet Porky, of course, with myself, the Porkmeister, and the rocket writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, how are you this fine day? When I say fine day, I mean fine day, but still very hot.
I'm just, you know, you can barely breathe, can you, in this?
Yeah. Yeah,
it's I've been having three or four showers a day, just yes, staying in the house, and every time I just feel overwhelmed by the heat, just dodging back in the shower again.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I've shaved my beard off because it can be.
Oh, have you?
Well, it's very, very short now. You know what I mean? I've put the old cheap shears through it because it can get very irritating this sort of weather. But there we are. Talking about the weather,
I've left mine on. I've become accustomed to it. Yes.
Yeah, excellent, Miss Jones. Well done. One aspect of this sort of weather is that it's very bright all the time. Now, Miss Jones, in a lot of pictures we see of you, you're often wearing sunglasses, okay? And, I think it makes you look very elegant and all that kind of thing, the air of mystery and all that kind of stuff. But I've got two pairs of what I would call, sort of working glasses. And one pair is a straightforward glass in it and a very thin frame. But the second pair, they darken depending on how bright it is outside. Do you see what I mean? So sometimes if I walk into a pub out of the sunlight, I actually look like I've got sunglasses on. And they're very, very useful in this sort of weather. But I was out yesterday and I was probably out in the day, you know, daylight, sunshine and all that, for probably 90 minutes altogether. And when I came home, my eyes were aching and I was having trouble adjusting to, you know, the amount of light that was inside the old penthouse flat here and all that kind of stuff. And then I realised that I'd read a piece some weeks ago saying that you do have to look after your eyes at all times because you can get sunburn of the eyes, which I didn't realise. Is that something you have realised and are now protecting yourself from?
Oh, absolutely. I've known that for years, yes. When we were children, we used to look at the sun, didn't we?
Ooh,
especially when there was eclipse or cyclips. I used to lie on the grass staring up at the sun.
Oh, golly.
Not realising. Oh, sure, I could be burning holes into my retinas. But I have been told now that there's this condition which I probably would need to have repaired in 5 to 10 years' time, and that I should wear sunglasses all the time when I'm outside of a building.
Really?
So that's what I do, yeah.
Golly, so something in your retina has been damaged then by the sound of it?
Yeah, probably when I was a kid and over the years. But in fact, everyone having their cataracts done, that's usually because of retinal damage from exposure to the sun as well.
Oh,
so we should all be wearing darkened glasses with Polaroid lenses, as opposed to just any old dark lenses that you might buy cheaply off the internet.
Yes.
We should all be wearing those at all times when we're out in the daylight.
Yeah, well, you know, it's something I learned from yesterday. It was so bright, I couldn't believe it. But most of the time when I go out, it's only for 5 or 10 minutes, and I spend the rest of the day in a pub. Not all day, obviously, but an hour or so or something like that. And that's in the shade, so I don't notice it. But how these people can sit out in gardens in burning heat, not just because of how bright it is, because the sun is bearing down on their skin, I don't know. But I've got a very strange relationship with the sun, so what would I know about it? Now, Ms. Jones, rock chick writer extraordinaire is your title. So what do we think of Harry now deciding he too is going to become a writer?
Well, he's not really, is he? He's not a writer at all. He's hired a ghostwriter who is an American called J.R. Moeringer.
I saw a post about him in the Daily Telegraph, a really extensive piece about him. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, I read that too. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner. He wrote Andre Agassi's life, which was considered one of the best sporting memoirs ever written. I've done quite a lot of ghostwriting in my career, and it's not an easy job because the primary aim of the exercise is to capture the subject's voice.
Yes.
And you can only do that by spending a lot of time with the person you're writing for, because you're writing in the first person. So you're writing as I instead of he or she. And the whole idea is that you give the impression that you are the actual person. You are, in this case, Harry writing the book. But Harry's not writing the book. He will do countless sessions with this guy, J.R. Moeringer, and J.R. Moringer will write the book. So it's a little bit misleading to the public who don't actually understand the process of ghostwriting.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. That Agassi book, by the way, it proved to be so successful because what Agassi said in it was how much he hates tennis. And tennis to him was a job. He hated it. You know, he dreaded getting up every day during a tournament and having to, quotes, go into work, which is an extraordinary sort of thing to say. A bit like John Lennon getting up every day and saying, I hate music. You know, I haven't got to write another song, have I? You know,
or a bit like a prince getting up and saying, actually, yeah, I hate being part of the royal family.
Yes,
you know,
right.
It's the same kind of thing. So this guy, the writer, has obviously got a sort of a stance, so, which is to expose somebody's position and to give the other side of what it's really like to be involved in that industry or in that lifestyle, in that world. And Harry seems hell-bent. Is he the one or is it Meghan? We can probably guess.
Yeah.
He seems hell-bent on destroying the monarchy.
Yes, he does.
And
did
Diana not say years ago that she would bring down the monarchy?
Well, I don't quite remember saying that, but I mean, there's all sorts of speculation about, you know, what her motives were in those days as well. The motives really are revenge. I mean, you're right, you know. Harry has now been turned into such a bitter individual about being the spare to the heir, if you see what I mean, you know, the son who will never inherit the throne, that I think you're right. I think he's decided if I can't have it, nobody's having it.
Yeah, William lost his mother as well. Yeah. We know this very well. William is not carping on or bearing his soul. He's just quietly getting on with it in a very dignified way, which you would expect. So William's actually the heir to the heir, if you like, isn't he? Because Prince Charles presumably will come first if nothing dreadful happens, please God.
Yeah.
But I just don't understand how he can do this to his grandmother.
Mm. No, I that's another inexplicable thing. You're so right. You know, the Queen's in her 95th year, I think, isn't she?
And 96 now.
96, yeah. And has been the most gracious woman on earth for, you know, the last 75 years, or 73 years or something, while she's been the Queen of England. And how Harry can turn like that, I just don't know. It actually beggars belief a bit, doesn't it? But anyway.
Who's his audience? This is what I always wonder. And this is what I say to everybody who ever approaches me to potentially ghostwrite their book. I have done a few. I've turned a lot down. I turned 3 down last year.
Mainly because
I thought that their motive was spiteful. It was vengeful, as you say, with Harry. And also the big question, who's your audience? Who's going to read this?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking in Harry's case, a lot of British people will turn their back on this. They won't want to read it. This is not going to be Andrew Morton's book on Diana, is it? This is Diana was such a greatly loved character.
Yes.
And we were all on her side. I feel that many people are against Harry in this scenario and that we might boycott the book.
Yeah.
Whereas I think in America, they might jump all over it because to them, Harry is almost an heir to the throne. They sort of misunderstand how the hierarchy works.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, if Meghan had a plan from the start that when she got together with Harry and then did she see from day 2 or day 3, member of the royal family, I could get into the royal family, then I could get out of the royal family with Harry as my valuable asset in Hollywood. I wonder if she planned it all the way along. And I'm not being like
this. No, do you think she's that calculating? Well, do you really?
I don't know. Maybe she got into the royal family. This is one theory that was put to me. She got into the royal family and she thought she'd immediately take over from Kate because she's a Hollywood actress and she's very good looking. And, you know, she was the sultry sort of, she's going to become the sultry princess, and then couldn't understand why she had to walk behind Kate at, you know, things like, you know, ceremonies at Windsor and all that kind of stuff, and then decided, I'm not going to be second rate to anybody. I'm out of here, you know. Who knows?
I think that people have been whispering in her ear. I get that impression.
Mm.
She would have to be a horrible sort of Lady Macbeth type character to have planned all that, to have targeted Harry. And this is what Piers Morgan suggests a lot of the time, that this was all a sort of grand plan, and that she did target an innocent boy and stole him from us. I don't think it's quite as harsh as that.
Well,
but I think people have been whispering in her ear and saying, look, you know, she was a second-rate actress, wasn't she, really? She only had series under her belt.
I've never seen her in an acting role, so I can't possibly comment on her abilities as an actress. What was it called again? Steps or something?
It was called Suits.
Suits, that's right, yeah.
And she hasn't made any films. She's not a big Hollywood star.
Yeah.
But I think something within her has been sparked that she could become the new Princess Diana.
Yes, I think so. I think you're right.
And she's hell-bent on achieving that, and Harry is her stepping stone. Yeah. That's what it's looking like to me.
Yeah, no, you may well be right. Getting back to ghostwriting books, by the way. You're absolutely right about having to get into somebody's head. I wrote Alan Brazil's book, and I came up with the title. There's an awful lot of bubbly in Brazil, okay?
It's a good one.
It was a good one. And funny enough, when we started writing the book, I realised that that title was prophetic, because Al had been drinking bubbly for, you know, the past 30 years, and therefore had a rather sort of tainted memory of his life. And I spent hours and hours. There wasn't the facilities around on websites in those days that there are now. You know, there wasn't huge social media. I was taking trips to Ipswich and Manchester, where Al played football, pouring through the logs of the books in the football libraries, and all, just to find out, you know, who Al scored the goals against, you know, and who he played against in certain European games and all that, because it all passed him by. And it can be terribly hard work ghostwriting if the person you're ghostwriting for doesn't have a particularly good grasp of the facts. For instance, you know, if Mick Jagger employed a ghostwriter, Jagger can't possibly remember the details of the early life of the Rolling Stones, because it was so chaotic, and it would have been blurred, wouldn't it, because of the way pop stars used to behave in those days.
And they were out of their head on drugs most of the time as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But Bill Wyman kept a very comprehensive record, the tickets and all the programs and everything else.
Yeah.
But Mick did famously accept an advance from Weidenfeld and Nicholson to write his memoir, and found A, that he couldn't remember very much, and B, that he wasn't really interested in the past. And he gave the first third of his advance back. People always report that it was £1 million and he gave it back. It doesn't work like that. As you know, you get your advance in three chunks.
Sure.
So you get the first bit when you sign the contract, the second part when you submit the manuscript, and the third part when the book is actually published, when it comes out.
Yeah.
So it was only the third chunk, would have been about £300,000, I suppose, but still a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
But he didn't want to do it, didn't need to do it. He's one of the richest artists in the world.
Yes.
Why should he bother, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. By the way, will you be seeking an audience with Mr. Wyman for your latest project?
No. Bill Wyman and I no longer see eye to eye, but he will be very much part of my book for reasons which will become apparent.
Oh dear, right.
When it's published. Yeah.
Sounds very intriguing. Talking about pop stars, by the way. I read a piece recently about a young lady called Rachel Stevens from, what was it, the group she was in, S Club 7, yeah?
Yeah.
And, you know, you read all these stories all the time about sliding doors moments and all that kind of stuff. She became a member of a pop group because she literally went to meet a friend in the Sony cafe, because the friend was working there at Sony, and a friend could get her a free meal because she was so hard up. And whilst in this cafe at Sony, somebody spotted her, asked her if she could sing, and she'd never sung before in her life. Within a few hours, she was in a studio, sort of, you know, being interviewed and doing a sort of demo tape. And from that, she became a very famous pop star and has now had a gilded life. I mean, that's a great good luck story, isn't it?
Right place, right time. You know, it's a bit like these model scouts that go around.
Yeah.
My daughter was telling me the other day that one of her friends in the bar where she's working for the summer, a guy came up to her and said, oh, you know, I'd like to give you a a studio test and so on. And nowadays the girls go, oh yeah, okay. Mm. But this guy did turn out to be a real model scout and gave her a card and everything. So yeah, look, it happens quite a lot. It happened to Naomi Campbell when she was 15. Yeah. She was walking through Covent Garden in her school uniform.
Yes.
And a model scout came up to her and gave her a card. So people are out there. This is their job, is to scout around and find the next big thing.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that unusual anymore.
No, I don't think it is either. I know a bloke whose job is to drive around the country and go into suburban streets and spot a house which is clearly owned by old people because the garden's a bit overgrown and the woodwork is not good. You know, it hasn't been painted recently and all that. And it looks basically dishevelled. You know, the curtains are a bit untidy. And this guy knocks on the door and says, hello, how are you? And he works for big development construction companies. And the idea is to buy the house off the old couple for £1 million, and it could be worth a lot more than that. It could be worth like 2.3 million. They might have bought it 40 years ago, you know, when they got married after the war or something like that. And then they acquire the house, and then they build 16 flats on it and make a profit of probably about 10 million or something like that. And that's his job all the time, to go around spotting property which could be developed. And the great thing is they buy this before they've even got any planning permission or anything. Sounds like a precarious job to me, but something I might think about getting into if times get hard.
But what about the old couple's family if they're leaving their property to their children or whatever?
They get the money from the house, don't they? Because the developer buys it off them and gives them the cash.
Yeah, I suppose. That seems very cynical to me.
Well, you know, I think the world has got to change and you've got to change. You know, if every building that was built in 1700 was still here, we'd still be all riding around in carts and things. But anyway, look.
Yeah, that's true.
I digress. Have you got all these horrible 20-mile-an-hour speed limits around where
They're everywhere. It used to take me about 20 minutes to get to my mother's from where I used to live in Dulwich down to Kent.
Yes.
Used to take me about 20 minutes. It now takes me up to an hour and a half because of all the speed limits on the roads.
I can't believe that. An hour and a half. I mean, do you comply by them? Are the cameras?
Yeah, I do because there are cameras everywhere. And they say, oh, you know, 2/3 of the cameras are not active at any given time. But you don't know that. You don't know which ones.
Yeah.
The thing that really bugs me, I do abide by the speed limits because they're there for a reason.
Yeah.
So if a person is hit at 20 miles an hour, they're more likely to survive a crash than if you're hit at 30 miles an hour. You're much more likely to die.
Sure.
And a child, of course, will be killed outright.
Yeah.
So I do abide by them for that reason.
Yeah.
The people who annoy me are the ones, and it happens every day, somebody drives up behind me and they intimidate me, they tailgate me because they want to go faster and I'm observing the speed limit. So what this does, first, the first reaction with me is that I'm terribly traumatized by that.
Yeah.
Because suddenly I'm not concentrating on the road in front of me, I'm concentrating on the road behind.
Absolutely.
Second thing is that I get angry because I can be quite aggressive in those situations and I drive even more slowly. Just to wind them up. And then, of course, they sometimes undertake you on the left-hand side, which is very dangerous, and they could cause an accident by doing that.
Yeah.
But guess what? You always see them at the traffic lights.
Yeah, of course you
do. Because they don't get very far.
Of course they don't. You're absolutely right. Because of course, there are so many traffic lights around now to just deter motorists. There's a type of person in this world who is in authority, in local authorities, who are determined to wipe cars off the road. I don't know why. I don't know why they suddenly hated cars. And, you know, now they're all going to go electric, but they still want them off the road. I just don't get it. You know, I think it's all to do with freedom, you know, because the world opened up, particularly in America, the vast amount of space America's got. Once they invented the internal combustion engine and fuel in America cost about literally 25 cents a gallon, these 6-litre cars could take 20 gallons of petrol and whoosh, you know, get off. And it introduced a huge element of freedom to people's lives. And Henry Ford started building millions of cars and all that. And then, of course, it spread around the world. Now people want to take it the other way and restrict our freedoms. Of that, I'm certain.
Well, we do have a much smaller country, of course, and we don't have freeways. We have motorways. But our motorways are nine times out of 10, they're jammed when you try and drive anywhere on a motorway.
Yeah.
But the other thing which horrified me, I read recently, one of the major contributors to air pollution, God, this frightened the life out of me. Just the act of driving your car causes all these tiny particles of rubber to be worn off your tires, which, of course, we know that tires wear out.
Yes.
But all those tiny, minuscule particles of rubber are going into the atmosphere, and we're all breathing those. And this is one of the major causes, not only of climate change and pollution, but it's also carcinogenic. It's cancer causing.
Well,
so we are breathing rubber.
Oh, we are. But this is another argument I've got against electric cars. Electric cars are going to be much, much heavier than a normal car because they have to carry a huge battery the size of the boot, okay? Because it's made of lithium and it's got to be, you know, have enough capacity for you to get 150 miles. Although the faster you go, the shorter distance you can go. But because the cars are going to be half as heavy again as cars are these days, they need bigger tyres, and the tyres are going to shred more quickly, and more of those tiny rubber particles you're talking about will be cast into the air. The other thing is, and I'm sure you've seen this, when you see a super-duper car like my Mercedes or something like that, you'll see on the inside of the front wheels like a red sort of bracket or a blue bracket, and that is the brakes. That's, you know, the very sophisticated brakes, which, again, when locked around the axle of the wheel, send out billions of tiny metal particles into the air as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that is frightening, isn't it?
It is. Talking about motorways, by the way, have you seen that the latest TV hit? I haven't seen it yet. It's a blinking show about a motorway service station. Few travellers would say a stop at a motorway service station was the highlight of their holiday, but T-Bay, T-E-B-A-Y, on the M6 may be the exception.
I saw this. It's in Cumbria, isn't it?
That's right. A television documentary about the UK's first family-run motorway services proved more popular than the Wimbledon tennis finals. I wouldn't have said a motorway service station was good enough to write a programme on. But I remember the first motorway service station we ever went to, when Mum and Dad took us to see an old auntie in Blackburn. We lived in Chester. And so we had to find the M6 in Cheshire, and we went on it for about 25 miles. It only just opened. It was the first part of the motorway in this country. It was called the Preston Bypass, but it turned into the M6. And I remember going into a motorway service station and thought what a wonderful place it was. And do you know why? In the loos, when you'd washed your hands, you stuck your hands into what looked like a sort of hole in the wall, and it was the first ever, you know, air, whatever it is, you know, hand dryer. And I thought, oh, this is a magic world.
Well, this one you're talking about, the one in Cumbria, it's not just any old service station with, you know, burgers and fish and chips and a branch of WH Smith. It's not that kind of place. It's an organic grocery, in effect, where you can buy wonderful artisan breads, local cheeses, and potted shrimps and all kinds of chutneys and that kind of stuff. Right. So it's very much a sort of farm shop, if you like. It's not dissimilar to the one that Jeremy Clarkson has got at his farm.
Yeah.
So it is not just any old service station. Mm.
Oh, right.
We should make that clear. Some people actually go in their cars and make a trip to that place just to do their shopping because it's the kind of organic foods and drinks and so on that they want to buy. So, I think it's a special service station and not just the kind with a hole in the wall to dry your hands.
Mm. Yeah, well, no, you may be right. Do you know what? I had a colleague in Fleet Street once, and he was very, very keen on a woman in the office, and eventually she agreed to go out with him. And
wasn't you, was it?
It wasn't me at all, no. And he was so short of ideas and so, what's the word I'm looking for? He so lacked grace in the company of women and that kind of stuff, you know. But they went out somewhere to like the theatre or something like that. And when they came out, he realised that there were no restaurants open. It was somewhere in Kent, I think. So he actually took her to a motorway service station for dinner.
Oh.
It didn't last long, that relationship.
Well, I was going to say she was busy the following week, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, washing her hair or whatever. Right, okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining Ms. Jones and myself for the latest podcast from Planet Porky. Just to remind our millions of listeners there, Leslie, and we did mention it in our last one, we are gearing up for an August holiday, aren't we? And you know what? I have to say, I'm really looking forward to it. I know that you can say, well, we've all spent so much time at home over the past 15 months and you know, we haven't been into work, so why do you want to get away from work? But it's the very fact of being at home. I definitely want to get away. And I know you said you're going to Italy, and that sounds lovely. I'm going to do a tour of Britain. I'm going to go to the northeast. I'm going to try. I might go to Cornwall and Devon, though I think it'll be absolutely packed. But I'm certainly going to the northwest, and I'm going to stay at the Chester Grosvenor Hotel, which is the world's favourite hotel for me. And I'm just going to get to know my country again.
Have you booked it?
No, I haven't booked it yet, no, because I didn't really know, you know, what the sort of dates are that we're going. But I'll work all that out.
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't just turn up, you know. I would try and book ahead.
No, we'll book it.
Because lots of people are doing the same as you. They're deciding to rediscover their own country and get around. And I think a lot of things are booked up. Be careful of those roads down to Cornwall. I mean, the M4, the M5 are going to be just a nightmare, aren't they?
Yeah, they're completely inadequate, those roads down into the southwest, considering how popular it is. I can't believe how... Because, I mean, that whichever is the one after the end of the M5, it's the A something. It's only a two-lane dual carriageway, isn't it, into Cornwall?
Yeah, it is. It sort of bottlenecks, doesn't it?
Yes,
it can take you 9 hours from when you get off the M5 just to get anywhere near Cornwall. But not as bad as the East Sussex coast, sort of down to Eastbourne, Battle, Pevensey, those kind of places. There is only the A21. There's no motorway goes through there.
No, there isn't. There's an A23 which goes somewhere. It goes down through Croydon and there's an A3 and there's an A21. You're absolutely right. No motorways. And that again is quite a hopeless case, isn't it? Now, I'm delighted to say, Miss Jones, that I've seen a few pictures of the woman I regard as the world's greatest actress and certainly my favourite star of the moment, and that is Jodie Comer, who plays Villanelle in Killing Eve, and they're making the fourth series. Now, I have to say, I cannot wait. I think she's the most magnetic personality on television. I know you're not a great television viewer, but you need to get to know Villanelle, honestly. She is literally a lady killer. She's an international assassin, and she goes about her job with great enthusiasm.
You see, I do watch television, but last night I watched a really good program about Leonardo da Vinci's greatest works.
Oh yeah,
that's the kind of thing that turns me on. No, it really does. But this kind of drama, which is always about killing people, or finding out who, you know, some of these things I've watched, the person gets killed in the first frame, pretty much, and the rest of the show is trying to find out who did it. Well, who cares, really? There are too many of these things on television. Yeah. I don't like the idea of entertainment being about killing people.
Yeah,
well, I'm sorry that I disagree with you on that.
Yeah, but this is real dark humour, honestly. It's really good. In one particular... Hey, they're coming after you, Leslie Ann.
Yeah, they generally do about this time of day,
They're coming to take you away, ha-ha!
Ha-ha!
Yeah, absolutely. My favourite killing from Killing Eve is Villanelle gets into a city institution and waits in the lobby for the boss of the company. And he comes in and she pretends to be a naive young sort of trader in the city and how much she admires him and, you know, I've followed your work for years and all that. And then he goes to the lift. And then he gets in the lift and he says, send a note to my PA, young lady, and I'll see what I can do to help. And she says, oh, no, you're going to help me now. And she grabs his tie, right, and pulls his tie forward as the doors close on the lift, right? And then she holds the tie, and as the lift goes up, she won't let go of the tie. So he gets strangled to death in the lift. And honestly, it's such
You think that's a good thing?
Yeah, well, it's a riveting piece of drama. I mean, it's real black humour, you know what I mean?
I just don't want to watch that. I mean, also, it's putting ideas into people's heads.
Well, nobody's going to actually do that in real life.
Well, they might. Oh. People get killed all the time.
Oh, no, come off it. Yeah, we can see it in my building. You know, it's 18 floors. Oh, somebody's going to reach in and grab your tire just as the doors close and kill you that way. I don't think so. I think you've got to take it all tongue in cheek. But I just think it's...
Well, I don't think it's a laughing matter, really, killing
people. It's not a laughing matter. Oh, dear. Miss Jones has lost her sense of humour. Oh, dear, what a pity.
Come on, so you're telling me it's funny to kill people?
Well, the way she does it is funny, honestly. But anyway, look, what I was going to say is it's always fascinating seeing these people out of character, because in this series, she talks like this because she is a Russian emigre, you know, and she's trained as an assassin. But in real life, she's a Scouser. She comes from Liverpool. She talks with a Scouse accent. And to my absolute joy, I found out that Jodie Comer's dad is employed by my club, Everton Football Club, as a physiotherapist. Isn't that amazing?
Well, it's not amazing. This is a nice little touch. I don't think it's amazing. No. I mean, her dad had to do something for a living, didn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. The other one, of course, and we'll get off this subject now because I know you don't like murder shows, but
go on then.
The other one is Peaky Blinders, which again I think is brilliant. And the lead character there is Tommy Shelby, and played by Cillian Murphy with a perfect Midlands accent because it's based in Birmingham. And yet, when I met him, when he came into a radio show at Talk Sport with Mr. Brazil and myself, he is as Irish as, you know, anybody who's ever kissed the Blarney Stone. You know what I mean? It's amazing how these people change their accents.
Well, yes, that's part of the art of being an actor, isn't it? Yeah. A lot of actors have speech coaches who teach them how to talk in other accents. Mm. I interviewed one years ago in New York when I was writing a book about Naomi Campbell. Oh. She'd worked with a speech coach called Sam Schwat, S-C-H-W-A-T. He's dead now. Very interesting guy. And he worked with lots of actors to help them to deliver, you know, accents other than their own. Yeah. And he told me a really interesting thing about accents, which is that they change every 30 miles east to west and north to south. So if you imagine, for example, that you live in America, say you live in New York, if you go 30 miles to the west, the accent is changed within that space. Right. Also, if you go 30 miles north or south, the accent is modified in that direction as well.
Yeah.
I was fascinated by that because you kind of wonder why. Why did those changes in accents come about in the first place?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. In fact, you remember the Ripper and the hunt for the Yorkshire Ripper, although you're very young in those days, obviously.
The Yorkshire Ripper, Yorkshire. I thought you meant Jack the Ripper.
No, not Jack the Ripper. Not
you might have been born, but I wasn't.
But you'll remember that the whole investigation was sidelined for 3 years when some joker sent in a tape saying he was Jack with a Wearside accent. And they did exactly what you've just said. They got all the great voice experts from all the universities in this country to try and pinpoint the actual street this bloke could have lived in. You know what I mean? But of course, they never found him because it was all a hoax. And I'm not sure he's ever been discovered. Now, tell me this, Miss Jones. I know you have very strong views on feminism and you're not a nutty feminist or anything like that. You stick up for women's rights. Do you think it's right that somebody wolf whistling a woman should now be prosecuted for it as an offence?
Technically, yes, but try catching the person who did it. You know,
it's offensive.
I think it is, yes.
I mean, women who like being wolf whistled, or certainly have done during my life.
I think it's threatening to most women. I know that most young girls, certainly girls of my daughter's age, just get really annoyed when things like that happen. You know, how dare you? It's especially when it's builders on a building site. It's intimidating, and it's designed to be as well. It's designed to be threatening. And I think
I think it's designed as a sort of a come on, in the same way that you know, we use the expression, I've given her the eye, or she's given me the eye, or something like that. Isn't it just a mating call? Sort of, you know, I'm making myself aware, I'm making you aware of the fact I'm here. And look, you know, I'm signalling the fact that I think you're very attractive. And who knows what might come of that? I think it's as innocent as that.
No, it isn't. It's almost always middle-aged men whistling at young girls, and it makes them feel uncomfortable and threatened. And for that reason, I think it is an offence.
Right. OK. Well, under those circumstances, yes, I would say it is. A bloke on a building site with a load of mates trying to look like the big guy and, watch me impress this bit of young totty and something like that. But certainly when I was younger, it was quite a... It's quite a common thing to do and pay compliments to barmaids and all that, which you're frightened to do these days in case anybody, you know, sort of misreads it and says, you know, how you're being insulting. Anyway, look, we have our different views on it. On
this- no, you cannot make personal comments to anybody nowadays. So no, if you're in a pub and if the barmaid is pretty and well endowed, you cannot make remarks about her appearance to her. The same as she couldn't make remarks about your appearance to you. It's completely inappropriate. Those days have gone, Mike. You're a dinosaur about this.
Well, you say that, but women are never, ever vilified or, you know, come under attack for making comments about men. Only a couple of weeks ago, and I'm sure you'll have seen this, it will have been in a publication and I both read, Rachel Johnson, who is the Prime Minister's sister, was actually giving marks out of 10 to the hottest hunks in the European Football Championships, which were taking place in this country. And I didn't see anybody bat an eyelid of that. Just imagine if a man had been employed to give marks out of 10 to women in Strictly Come Dancing.
Well, quite frankly, she's as bad as him, isn't she? She's no better than Boris. She irritates me because she's just provocative all the time. She's just looking for a headline. Yeah. So I'm sorry, I've got no time for her at all. But it's an inappropriate thing to do. They're not there to be ogled. Mm. They're there to play football.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. What was I going to say to you? On this day that we're recording now, in, I don't know what year it would have been, 92 probably. Anyway, sorry to fluster and bluster.
Get on with it, come on.
Yeah, exactly. John Smith died, leader of the Labour Party.
Oh, yeah.
He just did not wake up in his flat in the Barbican in London. Had he been to a reception the night before and had a couple of drinks, he liked a glass of whiskey, and he just passed away in the night. That was the start of the Tony Blair revolution, which of course now is a massively historical event in the, you know, the echelons of history in this country.
Do you think Tony Blair is going to make a comeback?
Well, he's doing very well at the moment because he's suddenly saying a lot of sensible things in, you know, the odd interview here and the odd newspaper article there, which a lot of people are agreeing with and seeing his value from the days when he was Prime Minister. Because let's face it, it all fell to hell the minute he stepped down and Gordon Brown stepped up, just like the Tories completely collapsed when Mrs. Thatcher stood down and, you know, that glass of water John Major took over. There are leaders who are so rare and come along, you know, so, I don't know, only decades, you know, a few decades apart. You should hang on to them.
Has it ever happened that a former Prime Minister has made a comeback and gone again?
Yes, many times, particularly in the 19th century. Gladstone, Disraeli, Pitt the Junior came back. It's happened many times, but not in recent times.
That's what I mean, in recent times. No, I can't remember it in my lifetime.
No, yeah. not in the 20th century.
No. Well, it's very interesting. How old is Blair now? He must be in his 70s.
No, he's not. I think he's, you know, like in the 67 range or something like that. Or...
Is he? Okay. Well, that's no age these days. Well, look, I mean, we have no opposition at the moment. No. Keir Starmer is a complete waste of time.
Yeah.
They need someone to shake things up.
Yes.
And quite honestly, the Tory party do as well.
Yeah, we do.
I can't see Boris lasting much longer. I think a lot of people have lost faith in him. Who would replace him?
If you look at the opinion polls, amazingly, he's still got an 8 or 9% lead over everybody else. But I think that says more about the opposition.
Yeah, I never believe these opinion polls, to be honest, because look when the elections come around and the predictions that are made, and it always goes the other way.
Well, yeah, I think the silent majority is largely responsible for that. The Blair thing, by the way, was I know Alistair Campbell very well, known him for years. I knew Ali, in Fleet Street before he even went to work for Blair. Well, he went to work for Neil Kinnock first and then for Blair. So, and the inner machinations, the way it all went on. But just for the benefit of our millions of listeners, basically, when John Smith died, Gordon Brown was the natural successor. You know, it was obvious he was the big beast, in, as they'd call it, in the party, ready to stride the stage and take up leadership. And then the master of dark arts, Peter Mandelson, sort of started whispering in people's ears that Gordon Brown is a rough, gruff Scotsman, doesn't have much personality, isn't terribly good looking, isn't even married, not a great candidate to lead the party. But have you seen this young man here, Tony Blair, married to a barrister, family man, three kids, drives a Ford Galaxy, smiles, has got big white teeth, and he became known as Bambi. And the pressure was put on Brown. Gordon, please step down for the sake of the party. You can be Chancellor. Gordon Brown, his life never recovered, never, ever recovered. But he did it because he knew that if he didn't, he wouldn't have the party behind him.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Do you think that Ali Campbell might make a comeback as well if Tony Blair gets back on the throne? No. Have they fallen out interminably?
It's not that they've fallen out interminably. It's just that Alistair Campbell is in no position whatsoever to put himself into, you know, office, power, responsibility or anything. He's gone way past that. And he has suffered serious illness over the years and a lot of it, particularly since he left Downing Street. He wouldn't subject himself to those sort of pressures and strains again. What could happen, of course, and it happens all the time, is he would become an unofficial advisor so that he wouldn't actually be in the public focus for criticism or anything like that, you know. But Ali advises people to this day all the time.
I know that. But something else sensational could happen is that Dominic Cummings could switch sides and become an advisor to Tony Blair.
I don't think they'd want him. Dominic Cummings now, to me, is so discredited. He's just a complete nutter. You know, he comes over as a man bent on vengeance whose, you know, whole life has been ruined by what he sees as a terrible treachery, how he's been cast aside and the victim of a war launched by the Prime Minister's wife, Carrie. I don't think any political party would take Dominic Cummings because I think everybody thinks now he's completely out of control.
He's a bit like Prince Harry, isn't he? He's the Prince Harry of politics. But why is the media giving him such platforms and he's still getting loads of television time and column inches and so on? Why is everybody listening to him in that case?
Because what he says is very interesting. But once you've listened to it, you think this guy's off his rocker. You know, he suggested the other day, about a week ago now, that he personally stopped Boris Johnson going to see the Queen after he pointed out that he might be carrying the COVID and he would give it to the Queen and the Queen at her elderly age would die. He claimed personal responsibility. Dominic Cummings said, I had to stop him. I had to grab his jacket as he was going through the door of number 10 and point out to him, you know, the huge consequences of going to see the Queen. Don't you think?
You ridicule that, but I can actually hear that happening. That has the ring of truth all over it to me.
I think half a dozen advisers would have pointed that out to Boris, both in Downing Street and another dozen advisers at Buckingham Palace saying, no, you're not seeing Her Majesty today. I'm sorry. You know, we don't know who's carrying what and all that kind of stuff.
You don't know. I mean, there's some authenticity to Cummings, which is hooking me, I have to say.
Yes. Well, there you go. You have to interpret it the way that you do individually. I've done a TV interview about caravans because I hate them. And it's going out a week on Friday. And that's because you mentioned Jeremy Clarkson earlier in this podcast. Jeremy Clarkson's got a program out that day about caravans and what he thinks about them and being towed all around the country. And I won't spoil the surprise for the viewers who are going to tune into that programme, but as to what he thinks of them. But I hate caravans. I don't know why they're still allowed on the roads between, you know, 8 in the morning and 6 at night. They should be banned. They just cause terrible traffic jams and who would want to live in a little square box anyway, eh?
Well, first of all, I haven't seen one on the roads for a long, long time, and I do spend quite a lot of time driving.
Right, yeah, but you drive around in sort of urban London. I'm talking about, you know...
No. I do motorway driving quite a lot, actually, because I'm, especially at the moment, because I'm researching a book, so I'm all over the place.
Yeah.
So I am on the motorways. I'm not just poodling around in London, as you seem to think. Yeah. Second of all, caravans. Lots of people can't afford hotels, bed and breakfasts, Airbnbs. So they still need to take their family on holiday. Mm. So what's wrong with a caravan on a caravan site? Some of my best holidays when I was a very small child were in a caravan in Wales, right, visiting family before my family could afford anything better than that.
Oh, hello, boy.
I don't see the problem. Mm? Yes. I think you're rather snobbish about caravans, to be honest.
Well, we went on a caravan holiday when I was a baby because I've seen the pictures years later, black and white, grainy black and white pictures my mum showed me. I don't ever remember being in the caravan. All I know is I hate caravans. I don't know why, but be confined in such a tiny space with one, two, or three other people is just inhuman, as far as I'm concerned.
But you don't stay in it all the time. It's only where you sleep.
Yeah, it's
just where you sleep, and you kind of open up the back or the side, and you do a bit of cooking on a little Calla gas stove and whatever else.
Lots of people
I know who are quite well off. Yeah. Have caravans down at Canvey Island or Birchington is another place. And they actually like doing it because it's a bit like posh camping.
Yes, I know. But, you know, it doesn't turn me on. But there, we'll agree to differ there. Do you think ice cream should be banned?
That's
this massive,
definitely
ridiculous foodie, you know, bullying tactic. Banning ice cream.
Not banning ice cream itself, per se, because you can buy ice cream in all kinds of places, but ice cream vans are terrible, disgusting things. They're dirty, they're usually clapped out old vehicles, the guy inside has nowhere to wash his hands. They should have been banned years ago. Overpriced, oversugary, full of chemicals. Who wants all that crap in their bodies? I think ban the ice cream van and get rid of them off the roads.
Well, I love ice cream vans because they remind me of my childhood. I still remember, you know, the excitement and the flutter in my heart when I heard the chimes of the ice cream van coming down the street, you know, and, you know, Mum, give me some money. I want an ice cream, you know, and all. I thought it was fantastic. I mean, we didn't really worry in those days about, you know, the things you've been talking about.
Yes, but we worry about those things now. And also, they're terribly polluting of the environment. Have you seen the black smoke that chugs out the back of those?
Absolutely. Oh, they're clapped out the vehicles now. I totally agree. But what about ice cream itself? You know, there's a move to say, oh, you know, children should be banned from eating ice cream because it's so bad for your health and all that.
Well, we've recently discovered Ben and Jerry's dairy-free ice cream, and it's absolutely delicious. So, you know, I'd go for that. There's less sugar in it and also no actual dairy products.
Yeah.
And they do a fantastic variety, which is a cheesecake. Mm. It's a cheesecake ice cream, which is just to die for. So have a go at that.
I love ice cream. I can't eat it these days because of the old diabetes. Although I do, you know, maybe once a year at Christmas or something, allow myself a scoop of vanilla, a scoop of chocolate, and a scoop of strawberry, all in the same bowl. And I have to say that.
At Christmas? Who eats ice cream at Christmas?
Oh, well, you know, maybe not Christmas. Maybe in the summer or something. You know, but once a year anyway.
Try the dairy-free one. I'm telling you, you couldn't tell the difference. If I gave you, here's some dairy ice cream and here's some non-dairy ice cream, you would not be able to tell.
Is that right? Now, Ms. Jones, it's Carlos Santana is 74, and he's said to be one of the greatest ever guitarists. He's rated above Brian May and Prince, and even by some above Jimi Hendrix. I mean, he was a bit of an acquired taste, wasn't he?
I think in his time, I mean, it was the fact that it was all that Latin kind of flavor, wasn't it? It was, I think, wasn't he the first musician to fuse rock with jazz and blues and salsa and African rhythms and all that stuff? And it was an acquired taste, but he did a fantastic cover of Peter Green's Black Magic Woman. Do you remember Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac? And I think a lot of people thought that Carlos Santana originated that track, but of course he didn't. And then there was the famous Samba Party and Oye Como Va. The first time, I suppose, that we had popular hits in foreign languages.
Yeah, I suppose so. I could never understand it much anyway, but that's trouble, isn't it? When you brought up on the Beatles, everything else seemed poor by
I think another thing is that, you know, these polls that vote somebody number 20 of the top 100 guitarists of all time, it's always subjective. It's always somebody's opinion. It doesn't really matter very much in the fullness of time. Just to be one of the greats is enough. It has to be.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't matter much to me. Yes, absolutely right, John Lennon line. Right, okay, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. Go back to sweltering. And I shall be spending the day trying to keep cool, probably in the back room of a quiet, shaded pub somewhere for an hour or two to absorb my journals. And to all our millions of listeners, thank you very much indeed. Hope you're all enjoying the sun and don't be put off by my morose view of sunshine. Ms. Jones, thank you. And we will see each other again and our listeners very soon.
Stay cool.
I've shaved my beard off because it can be.
Oh, have you?
Well, it's very, very short now. You know what I mean? I've put the old cheap shears through it because it can get very irritating this sort of weather. But there we are. Talking about the weather, Bob.
I've left mine on, I have to say. I've become accustomed to it, yes. Yeah,
excellent, Miss Jones. Well done. And then he gets in the lift and he says, send a note to my PA, young lady, and I'll see what I can do to help. And she says, oh, no, you're going to help me now. And she grabs his tie, right, and pulls his tie forward as the doors close on the lift, right? And then she holds the tie, and as the lift goes up, she won't let go of the tie. So he gets strangled to death in the lift. And honestly, it's such a
you think that's a good thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a riveting piece of drama. I mean, it's real black humour, you know what I mean?
I just don't want to watch that. I mean, also, it's putting ideas into people's heads.
Well, nobody's going to actually do that in real life.
Well, they might. Oh. People get killed all the time.
Oh, no, come off it. Yeah, we can see it in my building. You know, it's 18 floors. Oh, somebody's going to reach in and grab your tire just as the doors close and kill you that way. I don't think so. I think you've got to take it all tongue in cheek, but I just think so.
Well, I don't think it's a laughing matter, really.
Right, it's not a laughing matter. Oh dear. Miss Jones has lost her sense of humour. Oh dear, what a pity. I hate caravans. I don't know why they're still allowed on the roads between, you know, 8 in the morning and 6 at night. They should be banned. They just cause terrible traffic jams and who would want to live in a little square box anyway?